in association with Newsarama. Welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today we catch up with Dan Slott, and it's been too long. I had Dan on a couple years ago, and I can't believe it's been as long as a couple years ago. And we made up for lost time. It's a long conversation, but a good one. And I've chopped it up into two parts, but instant gratification. If you're listening to part one, all you have to do is click on the link for part two. It is posted right there with part one. And in this part one, we're going to be talking about Dan's amazing Spider-Man work. And then in part two, you'll hear about the Mighty Avengers. This portion of Word Balloon is brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where they offer a wide variety of absolute editions, omnibus editions, original graphic novels, trade paperbacks, hardcover editions, essentials, you name it, all with savings of 35% off the cover price. At InStockTrades.com, if you make an order of $50 or more, shipping is free. Here's some good examples of some Dan Slott material at InStockTrades.com. Plenty of Spider-Man material for you to catch up on if you're looking for the collection of Brand New Day Volume 1. The standard retail price is $19.99. At InStockTrades.com, just $12.59. How about Volume 3 of Spider-Man Brand New Day? The in-stock trades price just $9.44 as opposed to the $14.99 you'd pay as the regular cover price. Don't forget about In-Stock Trade's sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, DCBService.com, for all your pre-order needs. Every month, they give you values of 40 to 75% off certain books. To get all the details, visit the website, Discount Comic Book Service at DCBService.com, and In-Stock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Let's first of all talk about your Spider-Man arc that just wrapped up.
Woohoo!
That was very cool. And, I was wondering if he would reveal his identity or not to the family, because that was great. I thought that was really neat. I appreciated everyone's concerns about the reveal and the Torch's aggravation about it. And I thought it was a very genuine story and liked the way it turned out.
A lot of that was all fell back to my reaction when I first heard what was going on with One More Day and what was happening with the secret identity. And I was like, wait, no one's going to remember? But my Spider-Man Human Torch miniseries.
Absolutely.
No! So a lot of this was my inner fanboy going, oh yeah, that mini counts. So there.
Well,
and it will be coming out soon in a hardcover. Thank you, Marvel Comics.
That's cool. Now, your miniseries will be coming out in a hardcover.
Yeah, the old Spidey Torch mini, the only way to buy it was in the singles or as a little tiny itty-bitty teeny-weeny little digest. And now it's going to get the full hardcover treatment. And I'm, you know, I've been talking to Jen Grunewald at the trade department. Mm-hmm. We're going to try to put in some goodies in there, too.
Oh, very cool.
There's one goodie that I would love to put in there, and I can't find it in my hard drive or any old files, which was Paul Smith, when he did the covers for Spidey Torch, he would always include alternate covers. Like, you know, so you have your pick, like which one the office likes the best. Most guys, when they do this, they turn in, like, here's the real covers, and they always throw in one joke. Like, for example, for the Spider-Mobile issue, the joke panel had the Spider-Mobile mounting the Batmobile. And Batman shaking his head in shame and Spider-Man patting him on the back. Like, there's no way we could ever do that cover. And a lot of people felt that the cover wasn't working for the thing that I really wanted for the cover of issue two, which was, because we were going back to the coffee bean, and it was back during the days of Gwen. So I wanted Spidey and Gwen and Johnny and Crystal to all be like dancing the Froog at the coffee bean. And Kraven, who is the villain for that issue, and all his like animals kind of like peering in, like stalking them.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, and that's eventually what, you know, you see in that cover. But a lot of people felt like, you know, version 1, 2, and 3 weren't working. And Paul had put in as a joke cover, Spidey and the gang looking in, confused, and Kraven dancing the Froog with a gorilla. And supposedly, as the urban myth goes, Quesada saw this, went, oh, that's your cover. And I was so serious about my Spidey Torch video. Like, this is my one chance to write Spider-Man. No, I can't have that cover. Brevoort really let me stew in it for a long time. He's like, no, Dan, that's our cover. That's what we're running with.
That's an eye
catcher.
We're
going with that one. He just kept a straight face the whole time. And no, they got, like, the normal cover. They just wanted to see me, like, with my head spinning. Like, no! Not a dancing gorilla on my Spider-Man cover, no!
You know, those Romita images of, like, Mary Jane and Gwen dancing like that, like Betty and Veronica, basically, really were...
Oh, totally.
Yeah, totally among my favorite memories of Silver Age comics like that. Absolutely.
No one drew a dancing gal better than John Romita Sr.
You're here.
They all had that kind of, what a swinging chick.
And the cool fashions, too.
Oh, God, yeah. Beads and fringes and miniskirts and, oh, man, and thigh-high boots. It was crazy.
You betcha, man. So I also like the time compression in the story, which obviously was, you know, the whole device. But was that just fun? Because there, not a lot of time elapsed as far as Marvel Universe time. Certainly in Peter's life, a lot of things changed, and that was kind of fun. But it reminded me kind of in like Battlestar Galactica, when Beltar put his head down and suddenly looks up and it's a year later. I mean,
I had, you know, anyone who's read my previous work anywhere, like the Ren and Stimpy Masters of Time and Space special, or the Justice League Adventure story, The Moment, or even some of the weird time travel stuff we did in She-Hulk. I love time travel. It's my favorite kind of sci-fi. I love time travel stuff and building the little, like, one of the things I really liked about 591, when you see the shots of what's going on back on Earth, you start realizing we're building a little puzzle box, because you keep seeing the same, like, couple weeks over and over again with each character. But if you're paying close attention, you'll notice in the, like, the first page, you'll notice the scene with Carly and Harry, that when they're in the coffee bean, in the background in the window, you can see Randy Robertson and Nora Winters walking by.
Absolutely.
And then, like, you know, we set up the bit with Jonah where he's going to go to his wife's favorite restaurant.
Yeah.
And then we set up the bit where, you know, Randy and Nora are walking by the movie theater and you see Aunt May in the background. And then we pay off on the bit where they walk by. So it all becomes a little puzzle box by the end. And I really like that. One of the weird things about all the time stuff is when it came time to script it, I screwed it up. And that was so annoying because the way it was never meant to be Narnia.
Okay.
And, you know, if you read, you know, or if you read the Narnia books, you go off to Narnia, you have an adventure, you come back, you've lived a lifetime, but no time has changed on Earth. And it was never meant to be that. And I wrote it like that on the second issue, but not the first. I screwed up three balloons. Where everyone's scratching their heads when they read the book, because time runs faster in the macroverse, and it also runs faster on Earth. A lot of people didn't catch it. We didn't catch it. I didn't catch it. I screwed up. But if you look at, like, the first issue, that's not the way the rule works, that we see that time does go faster in the macroverse. But we have a scene in 590 where the Invisible Woman says, tells Alicia, yeah, last time we were gone, we lost 2 days. So there's something about the time distortion that when you go back, the time moves forward, too. And what it basically is it time works like an Othello piece. Have you ever played the game Othello?
Okay.
When you breach the time distortion, the polarity of the time distortion switches. Does that make sense? It was always... You know, we talked about it. It totally made sense to us when we were working on it, and I screwed it up when it was time to script it.
Yeah, no prizes for everyone. Who cares? You know, I mean, it was... Well, honestly, I didn't pick up on any disparity from the first issue to the second.
We didn't either. And because there were so many, you know, spinning plates in this story with Jonah as mayor and setting up all the relationships and all the deals with how the unmasking works, and we had so many things spinning that no one noticed it, and then it went out, and it was all my fault.
Yeah.
But one of the problems was when we ran the preview pages, we didn't want to reveal the resolution to the cliffhanger. So the preview pages ran, like, you know, three or four pages ahead, which started at the exact moment where you can catch the flaw.
Okay.
So it was like shoving it in people's faces in the preview, this thing that we didn't see, because we didn't see the forest for the trees, and suddenly we shoved a tree up on online, and people caught it in 5 minutes.
Well.
That doesn't work. They're like, oh, man, we were all worked so hard on these issues. And damn it. But we put up patches online.
Okay.
And we're running the patches in a letter column. And by the time we do the trade, it'll run right in the trade. I've re-scripted the three tiny balloons. That's the stuff that kills you with anything in comics. I obsess about stuff like that all the time. I remember talking to Brevoort after, you know, an issue of She-Hulk had seen print. And we'd already started building up on stuff. I go, you know, I got a great bit for that issue. And he's like, we did that issue. It's done. Move on. You know, but, you know, it's everyone there really cares about comics. So when you do something like that, it just, oh, it sticks in your craw.
Well, yeah, you see every flaw, I understand. And obviously, I guess, like you said, people did pick up on it. Good news is you're fixing it in the trade. And I guess that's what happens when you're dealing with a, you know, semi-weekly, three times a month, as opposed to, you know, a monthly book. I mean, how different are your deadlines because of the schedule?
My God, it is the toughest thing I've ever done.
Okay.
In comics. I used to have a reputation of being someone that would miss a deadline by a week or 2 weeks all the time.
Okay.
Like, you look at, since I came back from Marvel in 2004, mm-hmm. You look at my record where, you know, we put out 12 issues of She-Hulk in 13 months.
Okay.
We put out, you know, the 5-issue Spidey Torch mini in 6 months.
Okay.
8 issues of The Thing in 9 months. Like, I always keep losing a little bit of ground. And that just used to be me, par for the course. And one of the things that really had to change, especially once I started Spider-Man, was I just couldn't do that anymore. You do what you have to do and the job gets done. It's got to go out. It's got to see print. If you don't finish up your work and if this stuff isn't done, everything's dominoes lining up behind you. When we were doing the two-part Molten Man story with the resolution for how Harry came back, I was still kind of burnt from doing 6 issues of New Ways to Die, and working on the initiative, you just had to power through. You had to power through. You got to keep working. Got to keep working. And I remember Steve. You know, good editors will call you and crack the whip and. They'll do what it takes to do to get the work out of you. And I remember Steve going for the part one, this is our 36th issue of the year. You are not ruining the 36th issue of the year. We have been perfect. You know, you're not going to be the guy who drops the ball on issue 36. You know. And I'm like, okay. And I get it done. I'm all like, ah. And he's like, where's the next one? What? In part two.
It never ends.
That's our first issue of the new year. You are not screwing up our first issue of the new year.
Man. Well, you know, he obviously had good practice coming off of 52, and I know that's, you know, one of the reasons why he was chosen for the job. But other than cracking the whip, tell me about working with Steve.
Oh, Steve's amazing. See, you think about the logistics of this book.
Yeah.
About the amount of writers he has to deal with, the artists, keeping everybody fed, keeping everybody working, assigning the right artists to the right stories, making the schedule, doing the marketing, everything. And there's so much. He's amazing. We do, the other day, we had a massive conference call with everybody. We're constantly doing conference calls. We're flying the guys in from the West Coast to have meetings every once in a while. He keeps up these Google spreadsheets.
Okay.
That we all just keeping, not even trafficking it, just making sure it all works. It's astounding. If I were him, I would have cracked years ago.
Well, and
I would have cracked so long ago doing this. I think anyone would, and yet he pulls it off. And boy, do these guys have to on Marvel Editorial? They put in the hours. People just don't see it. How hard they work, and how the late nights they do. I'm just impressed by everybody over there.
Well, this is Wednesday when we're recording, and Wednesday evening, so people have gotten their comics, but for those who haven't had a chance to go through their list and read today, including me, I thought the oh shit moment was last week, when at the end of your story, J. Jonah Jameson is the mayor. Oh, yeah, of course, dude, it's a podcast, of course you can.
Oh, holy fucking shit.
There you go, attaboy. But,
I hope mom isn't listening.
Just don't tell her you did this show.
So no.
She'll skip this week. That's all right. I know she's a big Word Balloon fan.
She is.
But no, you told me before.
She's like, oh, my God, 2 weeks have gone by and they haven't interviewed Bendis again.
Nice. No, it's true. You're right,
You're probably not even listening to me. You're like answering his Twitter.
Exactly. I want to ask about that because I saw something on the Newsarama blog that there's a big kerfuffle about Marvel Twitters and the public comments made on Facebook and Twitter, appearing in comic news websites and used as fodder for comic news websites, and I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, no, I've been in big company retreats where we work out stuff for the year.
Yeah, absolutely.
And like seeing Dan Buckley turn around, going, "Are you people Twittering?" We're at our top secret huge retreat. And Buckley going like, "The Twittering stops now. Put down your Twitters." The worst thing is, it's like, it's bad. And, we live in this kind of like YouTube failblog.org society where you can't screw up ever and you can't look stupid ever because you never know who's taping it or who's filming it, and suddenly it's all over the internet. And with Twitter, it's a million times worse. Like, you say one stupid thing and someone takes it out of context and it's all over. Like, Fraction Twitter's like crazy. So I'm like talking to Bendis at one of these retreats, and Fraction's right over there. And Brian he's so giving and such a team player with everything at these retreats that I can't say what it is, but there is a point where people were talking about this very important story thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Brian was offering up a suggestion that, was interesting, and it was a really neat idea, but giving out that suggestion would have screwed over a lot of his own stories. But he was being like a team player. He had this idea, and he was throwing it out. And I said to him, like, "Are you crazy?" It's like, you're going to screw over your own stories with this. You're going to have to rip up track and write new stuff, and and I said to him, like, and he was saying, "Well, Dan, you got to do what you got to do to be a good team player and help out." And I was like, "Yeah, but there's a difference between doing that and saying, 'Hey, guys, I'm thinking of piercing my genitals. What do you think? Should I?'" And then I turn over, and there's Fraction Twittering, "Dan Slott is thinking of piercing his genitals." I'm like, I was giving a hypothetical. I was Brian in the hypothetical. Oh, you bastard.
Suddenly
it's all over the internet, me and my genitals and piercings.
Do you Facebook or Twitter? I know you have your message board at Jinx World, but is that as far as your public net face goes?
Yeah, for people who want to get in touch with me or see, stuff like Easter eggs and whatnot, I have Brian gave me a message board over at Jinx World,
mm-hmm.
and that's usually where I do back and forth with people.
Okay.
But I tried to set up a MySpace, and I'm old. I still have Tom as one of the people on my MySpace friends. I haven't figured out how to get rid of him. You know what I mean by Tom.
I do know, the creator of MySpace, absolutely, yes.
I don't understand this with the thing, So, I'm like Grandpa Simpson or something working on this. So it's so not me. I really... I know Quesada loves Twittering, and Bendis and Reed and Fraction and, all the guys in what I like to refer to as the Brian Michael Bendis iPhone posse. you know, whip out their iPhones in unison, and they're all cool.
Well, I'm sure
they're all text messaging each other while they're Xbox Live-ing playing Call of Duty.
Exactly. Well, that's the thing that gets me. I don't mind Twitter and Facebook and everything, but if you're, like, out in public and have already met with the person that you're with and suddenly feel the need to Twitter while you're engaged in conversation or whatever with the person you're with, it's like, that's where I'm like, hey, man, what the hell are you doing?
I can't text message or any of that stuff because my thumbs just don't do that. With the little tiny little buttons. You know? It's like that episode of The Simpsons where Homer got really fat.
Yeah.
And he has to mash the keys.
Or he's got the stick.
Yes, the stick, the dialing one. My thumbs will not do that. And also, you know, I've tried blogging. I really don't, you know, I type all day. The last thing I want to do is type again. I've been toying around since I got this new laptop, and it's got the built-in camera. I've been toying around with blogging.
Okay.
Because that's just pushing a button and talking. So I might put up some vlogs.
Ooh.
Ooh.
That'll be cool.
Yeah, there are parts of the culture I really like. Like, I'm addicted to, over at Quick Stop Entertainment, I love Song Fu.
Okay.
If you ever go, where they have all these amateur musicians and they give them a challenge and every week they have to, like, write up a song.
Oh, that's fun. Oh, wow.
Yeah,
Then you get
all the MP3s for free.
Oh, that's interesting. Do they make original songs? Or they do?
Yeah.
Okay.
They give them a challenge and they write up and then people get to vote people off the island. And then one of them wins Song Fu. And they also take, you know, professional musicians, and they're in an upper tier class. Like, because one of my favorite guys that I like, I've just been to two concerts this year. I love him to death. Jonathan Colton. For people who know the video game Portal, he's the guy that wrote the song at the end.
Oh.
I love his stuff. And he did, like, two seasons of Song Fu at Quick Stop. And his opening band, Paul and Storm, they still take part in it. So, really good stuff. This, not this past New York Comic-Con, but the one before it.
Yeah, last April.
Was one of the rare times where I abused my star power. Because I usually, you know, I don't want to be the guy like, you know, comic book star, move aside. But I had my little, you know, my little badge, my little, like, Marvel thing.
Okay.
I was sitting in the back row of the Venture Brothers panel, just, like, watching. And I look over, and there, one seat ahead and one seat over, was Jonathan Colton. It was, like, my favorite musician. I kind of, and he had his guitar. And I saw him, like, getting up, and I went, Mr. Colton, my name's Ed Slott, and I read Amazing Spider-Man.
Does he read comics?
No, but, you know, you say something like that, you're like, oh, you read Amazing Spider-Man. So I got to talk to him for, like, you know, all of, like, 4 minutes.
That's cool.
Like, that was awesome.
Absolutely.
And then he walked into the other room, and he was doing, like, an opening set for, like, the Kevin Smith panel. And it was right next door to Cup of Joe. And at Marvel, like, you know, you want to show solidarity to the chief, and you want to sit in the, you know, and cheer him on for Cup of Joe.
Sure.
And I'm sitting there, like, in the other room, like, waiting, like, I'm going to get to hear Jonathan Colton sing live. And I got to hear him, like, do the warm-up, which was the, you know, just testing out the system. He did a cover of an Eagles song. And then I'm like, I have to go. Sitting there the whole time, the Cup of Joe panel, knowing he's right next door, and, like, you know, trying to prick up my ear, like, listen to the left.
Bummer, man.
You know, hoping I can hear the dulcet strains. But no,
very
not
sad.
To be. But the Cup of Joe panel was really good.
Yeah, sure it was. Oh, I'm sure it was. Yeah. You know what I like that you do, and I noticed it on, I want to say it was this year, that you joined in across the street and were at Dan DiDio's Sunday conversation about comics.
That was weird.
Really, was it? Because you sounded very comfortable, actually, and it sounded great.
It was really weird. I was running really, really late on my Justice League Classified stories. And I had a thing put into my Marvel exclusive contract that I could finish them off. But when push came to shove, I always had all this Marvel work, and you got to do the Marvel work first.
Of course.
You're under exclusive. And I remember walking around, like, one of the New York Comic Cons, and I had already, you know, I had turned in as many scripts as I was turning in. In the end, they decided to have Dan Juergens script the rest, so they wouldn't have to wait on me.
Okay.
And but the project was done and out, and all the issues had come out. And I'm walking, and Mike Carlin sees me and goes, "Where's my script?" And immediately I go, "Ah, wait a minute." He's like, "Ah, gotcha."
Reflexive.
And so when I'm up there at that panel, it's like, I'm up there with Carlin. And I'm like, "So want that script?" He's like, "No." It's so weird.
But it's good.
Like the DC.
It was cool to, you know, it's nice to see that, you know, the horse race aside, and I think the public needs to see more of that. That everybody likes everybody, you know, you guys can get along,
God,
you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, yeah, well, I understand that because, you know, I've been able to see that and also watch you guys go back and forth across the street a few times. So, you know, some fans are hip to it. A lot of fans aren't. And I think it's nice that you guys are all able to get together and have fun. And it was the same thing when Johns and Bendis had a joint panel and then ended up inviting, you know, half the writing staffs of both companies up to join in on the panel, and everyone was just shooting the shit. It was good.
You know, people always say, "Oh, yeah, I'm for Marvel," or "Boo, Marvel, I'm for DC."
And, yeah.
Honestly, if you were to ask Quesada or anybody, you know, Coke needs Pepsi. You know, and
absolutely.
Pepsi needs Coke. If it suddenly becomes a one-horse race, then it's, you get better work out of everybody. You get a better vibe when there's that pressure.
Yeah, it sparks creatively, I'm sure.
Totally. Yes. And selfishly, I would really love the two houses to be able to break bread because I want to do crossover stuff, man.
We'd all like to see more of that. Absolutely, man.
I would kill. It's like, you know, if you have to ask me, like, what are, like, the big dream projects in my life? You know, right up at the top would be doing a Batman-Spider-Man crossover. I would kill to do a Batman-Spider-Man crossover.
That's interesting. I wouldn't, well, and I guess it's their differences that would make it an interesting story.
Well, it's like they've done one or two of them, and...
Specifically Batman and Spider-Man?
Yeah, this is going to sound horrible. I have this thing where you can have, like, the greatest movie in the whole world, and there's one wrong scene, and I will hate it. I will hate the movie. Or it can be the worst movie in the world, and it has that one redeeming scene, and I love it.
Okay.
Like, you know, I can watch, like, a movie like The Specials a million times. And Superman the movie is one of my favorite movies of all time. But Superman 2, I hate it. I hate Superman 2 with a fiery, burning passion.
What scene fucked up Superman 2?
At the very end, when Clark Kent gets his superpowers back, and he goes back to the diner.
Yeah, yeah.
And he lets a normal human being break all the bones in his body, trying to beat him up. Then he picks the guy up. He throws him down down the whole thing, into the glass of a pinball machine.
Yeah.
And I'm like... Superman, you prick! Superman would never do this. Superman's freaking Jesus. You turn the other cheek. You don't go, "Oh, this guy beat me up when I didn't have powers. I'll go beat the living shit out of him." No! Fuck you! You know, I hate that movie more than Superman 4, Quest for Peace.
That's
because
a bold
of that
statement,
scene.
Dude.
Because of that damn scene. I'm talking the movie with freaking Solar Man talking like Gene Hackman.
Yeah, that's not good.
No, and I put that movie above Superman 2 because of that. You know, screw rebuilding the Great Wall of China vision. I could care less about that. The thing that pisses me off is Superman beating the crap out of a mortal. A normal human being. That so ends the movie for me. It's like the Daredevil movie has that scene where he lets the rapist get hit by a subway car.
Joe Quesada. Jose Quesada.
Yep. That doesn't bug me as much because Daredevil is a darker character.
I understand.
It still feels wrong to me.
Okay.
But not nearly as wrong as Superman beating the crap out of a normal guy for petty reasons. I mean, you can read the old 70s books where, like, you know, Steve Lombard would constantly piss off Clark Kent, and Clark Kent would do wacky things to him with his superpowers.
Right.
Like he'd use his heat vision to melt his shoes to the floor.
Right.
Or zap off his belt buckle. But nothing that's going to send the guy to the ER.
That's true.
You know, there's a limit. That would always... Oh, okay, so getting back to that.
No, tangents are welcome on Word Balloon. That's good, Dan. All this was good.
The Spider-Man-Batman crossover that Marvel did with DeMatteis and Bagley is one of my least favorite comics of all time.
Interesting.
It's not because it's a bad comic. It's because it didn't live up to my expectations. Think Star Wars Episode One.
All right.
You know, it's like when the trailers for that came out, and we were all freaking out. I remember calling my friend on the phone, one of my best friends, and like, oh my god, did you see the Star Wars trailer, Episode One? Oh my god, it's going to be amazing! Oh my god! And I remember saying to him, it's like, if I get hit by a truck. If I'm in the hospital and they have me on a machine, do not pull the plug. Get my body to the theater.
Nice.
I must experience this through osmosis before I die. And then you go and see it, and you're like, what a piece of crap.
Well, was the DeMatteis Bagley, was it a Treasury edition?
It was, well, no. What do they call them?
Amalgams?
The
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't an amalgam. It was just a straightforward Batman-Spider-Man adventure.
Okay.
And all the Bagley art looked great. My problem was, in my heart of hearts, you know, I always wanted to see these two characters team up.
Sure.
And you know what? Let's just see, you know, Scarecrow and Electro try to rob a bank. And they stop them. Yay! And instead, it was Joker and Carnage and all this talk about serial killers and who was abused as a child and
interesting
and dark looks into their psyches. I'm like, fuck that. I want to see him throw a batarang and you shoot a web. Come on.
Well,
I don't want all this deep introspective crap. I want that story for the 8-year-old in me. I want that. And you know, on some level, that's not fair to go to the creators. Why didn't you give me the exact thing that was in my head? But it was so disappointing to me because it was this dark look, you know.
Uh-huh.
On the flip side, you look at the Chuck Dixon, John Romita Jr. Batman Punisher crossover.
Yep,
that's amazing.
That one I read.
And yeah, that's dark, but it should be dark. It's Batman and Punisher.
Sure. We'll get back on track. And for those of you who haven't read this week's issue yet. Now would be the time to turn it down. And I'll even say in the intro how long
spoiler.
We spent on the oh shit moment and let you know when
spoiler.
You can come back and listen again. So if you didn't catch it in the intro, yes, turn your iPod down now. I'm not on the radio right now. Okay, so what happened, because I haven't read it yet today, what happened in Waite's story that was the big oh shit moment?
It was much bigger than Jonah's mayor.
Okay.
Peter Parker is being Spider-Man 24/7. And part of that means that he's kind of ripe. So he's been, like, you know, in the same costume for a couple of days.
Okay.
He's really stinky. And he's out by Queens, so he figures, you know what, I'll just pop into, you know, Forest Hills, and I'll get a change of clothes and a shower, and I'll stick the spider suit in the washer.
Okay.
And he hears something coming from upstairs, and he walks into Aunt May's room. And she's in bed naked with J. Jonah Sr.
Ew.
And they're doing it.
Ew. Wow.
He walked in on Aunt May in bed with a man.
Ew. Yeah, very wrinkly J. Jonah Jameson Sr.
Yeah, 80-year-old wrinkly people. Ew. Greatest ending to a Spider-Man issue ever. Don't see that one coming. Mommy. I just read Spider-Man. I need therapy.
Yeah. Does he go blind like Hank Hill when he saw his mom and her boyfriend having sex or whatever?
You will have to tune in next week.
Interesting. There you go. That's a good cliffhanger. Wow, man. Yikes.
You'll have to tune in next week. I love the opening of the next issue, though, I got to say.
You know, I've enjoyed all these new characters. And I really, Mr. Negative, I think, is a great new villain. And I think very, very interesting character. And
I can't wait for people to find out more about him.
Cool.
I'm someone who likes to, you know, roll out more and more stuff over time about what the secrets are, you know, behind these characters. Sometimes, like with Mutant Zero, I go a little too long. But in the case of Mr. Negative, for example, Fred Van Lente is doing a mini.
Oh, okay.
And we talked a lot on the phone, and I gave him some of the, hey, if you want to drop this revelation and this revelation and this revelation, feel free.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so there actually might be some big things about Mr. Negative. One of the things that, you know, I'm pretty sure you're not going to find out is his ties to previously established Spider-Man characters. Let's leave it at that.
Fair enough. I know the Big 600 is coming soon, and
yay!
Saw you reflect on that on your message board, and you were referring to the Diamond Solicit that all we know right now is Dr. Octopus is involved, and it's his first appearance since Brand New Day?
Yep. It's the one of the things we wanted to do working on this run of Spider-Man is take the villains off the table for a good half year to a year.
Mm-hmm.
So that when you brought them back, you could bring them back big. And this is when people get to see what our plans are for Doc Ock. It's exciting. I don't want to give anything away.
but I will say
issue 600 is huge.
Cool.
It is an enormous, gigantic issue. I've been telling people you could just snap some wheels on it and ride it home. It's a 104-page comic.
Wow.
Yeah, with covers by your choice, Alex Ross, John Romita Jr., Joe Quesada, and John Romita Sr.
Very cool.
Yeah. We've got, it's already been solicited, we've got a story in there by Stan Lee and Marcos Martin.
I saw that in the solicit. That's awesome.
That's beyond awesome. We've got stories from the other webheads, but I get to, John Romita Jr. and I get to do the giant 60-page story.
Wow, man, that's one story in that issue, and it's 60 pages. Holy shit, man!
60 pages. Something that would normally take us like 3 issues to do, you're getting it in one shot.
That's great, man. That's really cool. Now that's a 600. I like that. I mean, and again, I don't want, because I know Thor just had his 600. I mean, no disparaging comments to Straczynski and Quapel, because I think they did a lovely job with 600. But that's cool. That's huge.
You are getting 104 pages of all new material, no reprints.
Oh, I'm very happy with that.
Wacker is very proud of that. Wacker has insisted on that. You know, no reprint stories. This is all new material, and I think it's coming in at $4.99.
Okay.
So for $5, you're getting 104 pages.
Well, shit, that's a graphic novel, man. I mean, seriously, that's great, man. Very cool. Good for you guys.
There's also going to be around that time an annual by Mark Guggenheim, and with beautiful art by Pat Olaf, which
Excellent.
Is going to have. We're building up to a wedding, and you're going to get to see more stories about what's happened, an important step in the wedding, in the annual. So
okay.
There's a lot of cool things coming up, and like a lot of stuff we've been doing, like you get to the end of 591, and you're like, oh my God, J. Jonah Jameson's mayor. you're in for like season 2 of Spidey.
That's...
And when you get to the end of 600, we're going to ramp up some stuff there, too.
Interesting. That's really cool. Well, I have to say, I wasn't, a hater when Brand New Day was announced, because I'm like, I'm up for anything that's new. Anybody wants to shake the status quo, I'm old enough now where it's like, by all means, I want that kind of gut reaction of, I can't believe you're doing this. And in a good way, that's what's been going on, and that's been very fun to see.
Well, the way I'm looking at it is with the arrival of Joe Kelly and Mark Wade and this new thrust, we're kind of out of Brand New Day. We're Amazing Spider-Man again.
Sure. No, I hear you, man.
This is wave two. But I hear you. One of the weird things of working on this book has been some of the diehard fan reaction. We you know, One More Day wrote one of the most beloved characters out of the book. You know, someone who had been around for, you know, 20 years of marriage and, you know, even before. Like, I own the first issue where Mary Jane appears on camera.
Yep.
So she's been in this book for some time, and suddenly this character, like, if you think about different generations or different people jumping in to read the book at different times and different eras, I think the average reader today, all they know is a Spider-Man and Mary Jane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the cartoons and the movies, and suddenly this character was written out of the book. And that made a lot of people angry. I'm not even talking about the marriage or status quo change or X, Y, or Z. I'm talking about just writing Mary Jane out of the book.
Your little scene, by the way, last week was hilarious on the phone machine. Hi, Tiger. Beep.
Message erased. Yeah. So far, why am I the only guy sticking my head out of the whack-a-mole to do the Mary Jane scenes? Come on, smack me in the head.
That was good.
But that's a lot of the fan reaction is they're waiting there with that mallet. They're waiting there. They're angry, some of them, you know, like
yeah.
The diehards, the guys who are still complaining about this online. It's bizarre. It's like everything we do is through a lens of, I know they did something wrong.
Yeah.
No. That they're waiting for a shoe to drop. They're waiting for an issue to suck. like for example, it's like when you have something like Mark Miller and, you know, and Steve McNiven doing Old Man Logan.
Uh-huh.
And they're just throwing crazy stuff out there. But everyone's walking in going, hey, it's Mark Miller and Steve McNiven. Yay! Old Man Logan in a weird future! And they walk in with a complete suspension of disbelief. You know? And,
right.
And suddenly they can do something like Venom on a dinosaur. And they're like, that was so cool! Venom was on a dinosaur! That was awesome! Where if we had a dinosaur run through Amazing Spider-Man with the symbiote on it, I can guarantee you the first reaction would have been, one, would have been, meh. Two.
I hate that word, too.
The next one would have been, this sucks! Venom on a dinosaur? That's the stupidest thing I've ever seen! And then the next one would have been, Spider-Man fought dinosaurs before it was Stegron. Oh, rehash! I can already, and I can tell you which screen names would say each one of those three responses.
Oh, I understand,
so it's
man.
Like, you know, they're waiting for us. We could do the most spotless thing in the world. It's weird when you are, you know, the worst thing you can do is argue with a fan. The worst thing you can do is go online and talk to one. Every now and then I'm tempted, and every time I do it, I regret it. Like, we had someone in She-Hulk just angry as hell that Awesome Andy beat Sandman with a vacuum cleaner. How dare Awesome Andy defeat Sandman with a vacuum cleaner? You've ruined the integrity of Sandman. If Stan Lee ever saw you do this, he would be rolling in his grave. He would kill him first, and then he'd roll in his grave. It was just going on and on and on about this. And I kind of poked in and went, did you ever read the first Sandman story that Stan Lee wrote?
Yeah,
you know how Spider-Man defeated Sandman in that story?
Wasn't it a vacuum cleaner as well?
Yeah, it was with a vacuum cleaner.
That's what I thought. That's why I'm like, what's the problem, man?
And then the guy would be like, shut up! Running away. You're like, and the thing is, you know, you feel really pleased with yourself for like, I won him in a geek fight. But the sad fact is, the next 50 posts that guy does is, Dan Slott sucks, and here's how he screwed up this. They're just looking for something to be wrong. It's not worth poking them with a stick.
If it's any consolation, I have my haters online as well. So that's, you know,
I was talking with Brian about this. you know, like, because what it really is like, the more high profile a project I work on, the more haters you get.
I believe it.
You know, the more eyes you get on your work, the more people are gonna you. Just inevitably, you're going to get more people who hate it. I don't, like, I look at issue 590 and 591 as I'm very proud of them, and I was really happy with how they worked out. And with that one glitch aside, I was
sure.
I was very proud of those issues, of the script, of all the story beats. In my mind, it's the exact same caliber of work I was doing on Spider-Man: Human Torch.
But I agree.
But yeah, but people who read Spidey: Human Torch, they kind of give that distance, and it suddenly becomes even better. And then they look at this and go, oh, this didn't live up to it. And it's just, it's a weird place to be, and I'm like, no, this is good. I mean, I wrote in 591, like, one of my favorite lines of Thing dialogue I've ever written. I like it more than anything I did in all 8 issues of The Thing.
Tell me, which one?
It's the bit where Ben is, where Johnny and Spidey are just going at each other back and forth and back and forth, and Ben just can't take it anymore. And he tells them both to shut up, and then he gives them the Newt Rockne speech. You know, like the,
yeah.
You know, we're here on a mission, and you know, you're gonna. Where is it? It's, he goes, don't you get it? When the Fantastic Four takes you in and fights side by side with you, you're not just friends. You're more than family. You're not a team. You're the team, the world's greatest team. It's no, I want this or I'm doing that. You know why? Because there's no I in Fantastic Four.
Atta boy.
I know. I was writing that, and I'm just, like, typing and typing. And Ben said the line. Sometimes they just say the line when you're typing. And it started cracking me up. And I went, like, and I had, like, Reed and Sue quickly go, but Ben, he's on a roll there.
You know what I really liked was that visual moment when, you know, they take the risk and he does unmask and they remember. And it's good to see you, Peter. And I just love Ben's hand on Peter's head.
Yeah.
It was a real family moment. It was a family moment. And these characters deserve that kind of moment in that story and stuff. No, man, I honestly loved it on 2 levels. I thought it was clever, and also I just loved the fact that it was this great 2-issue story. It really was. It was just a fun romp, and to get it that quickly. I'm all for a good long 6-issue arc when it's deserving, but that's been the fun of this run on Spider-Man as well. You have good single stories. The Guggenheim Flash Thompson story
Flash Thompson story was amazing.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
Outstanding. And honestly, man, I mean, and the great thing about it coming out 3 times a month is, you had a good cliffhanger going into part 2, but immediately next Wednesday, you know, it wrapped up, and it was this nice Spider-Man and Fantastic Four family story, good adventure, funny stuff. Loved all the time stuff as well, and all the things that were happening to the Spider players around them. And, it hit on a lot of levels. Seriously, man, I think you should be proud of those 2 issues. I think it was a great story.
It's weird. I've seen a complaint about the subplot stuff, which is, oh, what lazy writing. They jumped ahead. They fast-forwarded through everything. And one of the things we find out, especially when we're doing these Spider summits, is everyone in the room has like a million ideas for the supporting cast. And eventually someone like Brevoort slams her fist down on the table and goes, this is a book about Spider-Man. You know? This isn't the Harry Osborn book, or this isn't the Carly Cooper book. This is about Spider-Man. Like, get it back to Spider-Man. So we have all these ideas and all these things we want to do. And one of the fun things, you know, we knew we were coming up to the time distortion. And we knew that was going to be one of the fun things, is getting that rapid-fire soap opera coming at you, like, at high speed. And hopefully, you know, if it worked, part of the feeling you should have as the reader is, oh, my God, Spider-Man is missing all of this.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm like, oh, no, Nora's hooking up with someone else. He was going to ask Pete to that concert.
Yeah, yeah.
No, you know. That's all part of the fun.
Well, and I also think, I understand what Tom's saying, but by the same token, there are so few characters that have rich supporting characters surrounding them where you do give a shit. You know, you give a shit about Ben Urich. You give a shit about Betty Brant.
Wasn't the Wade done in 1 issue really good, the look at Betty?
Yes, although...
I love that. It got overshadowed in the Obama mania.
You're right, but, no, I love that story, too. You know, if I can, Dana, and this is my only, like, fanboy slight quibble, I'm just, I miss that Betty and Peter, and maybe I'm remembering wrong from the Bashky cartoon of Spider-Man, but didn't they have more of a relationship before the retcon? I mean, weren't they really dating?
They were. There was. He always kind of wanted to date Betty. She was this mysterious older woman when he was back in high school and having problems.
Right.
With,
right.
With Liz.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
Liz wouldn't give him the time of day.
Sure.
But they ended, the way we've been playing it since we've had a go at the book is almost a brother-sisterly relationship. That she is like the big sister to him, and he is her big brother.
Okay.
Kind of characters.
No,
like she's the one trying to help him find an apartment, or she's the one hooking up Aunt May, and she's the one, you know, that getting to that. The other neat aspect about Betty that we've been playing is that she's the one member that didn't jump ship at the Bugle.
Yes.
She's the person who stayed behind. You know, everyone else is over at Frontline now.
Right,
and
right.
That does make her a bit of a pariah, which is an interesting flavor.
Well, that's
her character.
True. That is true.
And since Flash isn't, you know, mired in all of that Bugle stuff, and Flash and Betty have had a relationship in the past, Flash gets to be, you know, part of that inner circle with Betty, too. He can kind of, and still be friends with Harry, and still be friends with all these other people.
Sure. Well, I just, you know, and maybe, again, another, I might be misquoting, and if I am, sorry, but I remember reading that Joe Quesada had said that, you know, maybe it would be inappropriate for Peter and Betty to be that different in age and dating. And my thought was, well, like, who's to say that Betty was that much older than Peter? And I always kind of took it that, especially given being in my 40s and stuff, that maybe she was just a kid that went right to work as opposed to go to college.
I believe Kurt Busiek in Untold Tales set up a lot of that.
Okay.
That Betty
was older.
No.
Oh.
Wasn't that much older.
Oh, excuse me. Okay.
But, you know, in this age of Ashton and Demi, I have no problem. I have no problem with that. But we're going to, you're going to have to wait.
No problem, man. No worries.
We've got stuff. plan, but one of the things that I love that we've done with this book is that somehow over the years, the supporting cast really dwindled down to MJ and Aunt May.
It did. You're absolutely
that
right.
That was it.
Yep.
That was totally it.
You are correct.
You know, maybe in like the Peter David Friendly Neighborhood books, you started seeing a return of Flash and more Jonah stuff, but for the most part, it just became like the Peter, Aunt May, and Mary Jane book. And since they all knew he was Spider-Man, MJ and Aunt May, it was like this weird kind of, he didn't get to react with the normal world. He didn't get to have a Peter Parker life. You know, yes, he's married MJ and Aunt May is his aunt, and that's family. But he didn't, on some level, everyone knows, you know, everyone in his inner circle knew he was Spider-Man. So he never, on some level, really got to be just Peter Parker. And that's one of the things I like, is that now he can be Pete. He can take off. That scene was really important to me, where he has that talk with Johnny and he's pulling at the costume going, this isn't who I am. You
no,
know?
I do.
It's, he puts on that suit to become Spider-Man. When he takes that suit off, he's Peter Parker. You know, he's such a unique character. And it's fun to let Pete be Pete. And to have this rich supporting cast again,
No, I was just going to say, more heroes can benefit from that kind of supporting cast, and you're right about that. And I mean, it's what makes Superman still a great book because of, you know, Perry White and Lois Lane and Jimmy Olsen and all the regular people around him, allowing him to be human. And again, same thing with Daredevil, with guys like Ben Urich and Foggy. And I think you're right. It's one of the things that drove me nuts in Batman, where everyone around him needed to put a mask on. And as much as I even like Renee Montoya and have warmed up to the idea of her as the Question, I'm like, ooh, I don't want to lose another interesting bystander citizen that is an important part of the Batman universe and can be that Greek chorus saying, wait a minute, let's look at this on a human level and have the, you know, that kind of voice in the book.
Yeah, because on some level, Spider-Man, when people look at Spider-Man, they need to see something larger than life. Something crazy. you know, this man swinging above your heads. And on this other level, you need to have Peter react to the world on a human level,
mm-hmm.
so that he's someone that you associate with. It's so weird. I see all these people arguing online and in the comic shop, and one of the debates I hear a lot is people say Peter Parker's the everyman. And then these people vigorously go, no, he's not. And what the no, he's not people are saying is, Peter's a super genius. Yes, he's a super genius. And that makes him different than an everyman. But mm-hmm. what makes Peter the everyman is he's the superhero who gets a cold.
Yeah.
He's the superhero who stubs his toe. He's the superhero that can't always make ends meet, and things don't always work out right for him. The same way things don't always work out right for you. That's what makes him an everyman. Not his abilities at math or science, or that he should have this, you know. What makes him that everyman is that he's someone we can associate with, and he has all our problems and our foibles.
No, I'm with you, and I think I congratulate you guys. I think the book is I enjoyed the Straczynski run, and I enjoyed when Paul Jenkins was writing the book and writing Spectacular. And
you know what I love most about the Paul Jenkins run?
Go ahead.
Besides the wonderful Uncle Ben flashbacks, all the Uncle Ben flashbacks with Paul Jenkins were wonderful.
They are cool. Yeah. Paul really knew how to tell a lot of personal stories. Go ahead.
One of the biggest problems with Uncle Ben is he's Obi-Wan Kenobi. what I mean by that is when you watch Star Wars, the amount of time that Luke actually physically knows Obi-Wan Kenobi is the time from the minute Obi-Wan helps him in the desert, takes him home, finds out his parents are dead, gets a ship, the amount of time it takes to commute in the Millennium Falcon. You know, and then running around having the mini adventure where they're separated the whole time.
Yep.
So he only really knows Ben in the desert, selling his car, and commuting on a trip. And yet when Ben dies, it's the worst thing in the world. I love that man. I flew in a ship with him. I sold a car with him. He gave me a lighting stick. You know, and it's something like it's the most important thing in the world. And yet when you read Amazing Fantasy 15, there's like all of two frickin' panels with Uncle Ben. You know, we're told how much he loves Uncle Ben.
Yes.
But we don't even see the body. You know? Your uncle got shot. My uncle got shot. No! You see Uncle Ben, like, shaking him awake. And then saying, oh, you're fattening them up, May. That's it.
You're right. I think that is the dialogue. Very good, man.
You know, you get like two panels of them. But that's the beauty of Stan Lee, is that, and Steve Ditko.
Yeah.
For those two panels, we freaking love that guy.
Absolutely.
But it's Obi-Wan syndrome. And, you know, he said, like, no. You know, Uncle Ben, I will forever dedicate my life. For with great power must also come great responsibility. Bum, bum, bum. And for the most part, you know, you read the whole, you know, you get like 200 issues into Spider-Man, and you don't see that many Uncle Ben flashbacks. You know,
yep,
he might
yep.
be a glowing head going, I must always do this for Uncle Ben. He gave me a microscope.
Wow, Dan's just starting to roll, and we were just starting to roll. In fact, we continued to talk for another hour. Now, we've reached the end of part one, but part two is available immediately. So if you only downloaded one of these episodes, don't forget there's part two. Just go back to iTunes or follow the link at wordballoon.com or even at Newsarama. You can download part two and listen more to our conversation with Dan Slott. This portion of Word Balloon is brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where they offer a wide variety of absolute editions, omnibus editions, original graphic novels, trade paperbacks, hardcover editions, essentials, you name it, all with savings of 35% off the cover price. At InStockTrades.com, if you make an order of $50 or more, shipping is free. Here's some good examples of some Dan Slott material at InStockTrades.com.
plenty of Spider-Man material for you to catch up on if you're looking for the collection of Brand New Day Volume 1. The standard retail price is $19.99. At InStockTrades.com, just $12.59. How about Volume 3 of Spider-Man Brand New Day? The in-stock trades price just $9.44 as opposed to the $14.99 you'd pay as the regular cover price. Don't forget about In-Stock Trade's sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, DCBService.com, for all your pre-order needs. Every month, they give you values of 40 to 75% off certain books. To get all the details, visit the website, Discount Comic Book Service at DCBService.com, and In-Stock Trades at InStockTrades.com. John Sutra saying thanks again for listening to Word Balloon, and appreciate your support on every episode. You know where to find old episodes of Word Balloon, don't you? WordBalloon.com. You can also look for us at iTunes. We have our MySpace page, myspace.com/WordBalloon. You can follow me on Facebook under my name, John Suntress, or on Twitter, where I am under the moniker John Word Balloon, all one word. And if you have any questions about the show, we have a forum set up at WordBalloon.com that's hosted by Jinx World, Brian Bendis' website. And then we're also available via email if you have any questions for me, john@WordBalloon.com. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2009.